For commentator Dennis O'Toole, the corn syrup and ketchup isn't the only significant thing that's jumped in price, along with the cost of corn.
The world's most important liquid is more expensive than it used to be. No, not oil. Beer. The price of hops have jumped from 80 to 450% thanks to a worldwide shortage. A 20-pound bag of malted barley is up as much as 57%. As a result, microbrews and imports are often $3 more per six-pack than a year ago. And yet our politicians prattle on about the war in Iraq, health care, and the mortgage crisis. Enough. Let's talk substance. Let's talk beer. Barack Obama may be the only candidate who cares. He recently ordered a PBR while campaigning. Some say he was pandering to the blue-collar vote. But is this finally a candidate who feels our pain? Our leaders should, nay, must step in. This week, the Senate voted to stop sending oil to the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. We have a Strategic Petroleum Reserve. Why don't we have a Strategic Hops Reserve? Why hasn't anyone proposed a beer tax holiday? I'm not saying it's a great idea. I'm not even saying the conclusion of this essay makes sense. I'm just saying... I'm sorry, what was I saying?
Dennis O'Toole is an improv comedian. He lives in Chicago. He's 33 years old, and he wishes someone, just anyone, would still card him.
Here's an idea for saving endangered species. Slice them up and slap them on the grill. That's the premise behind a new book, Restoring America's Food Traditions, Saving and Savoring the Continent's Most Endangered Foods. We stopped by the local farmers market to test out the idea.
So, if a species is endangered, you should eat it.
No, you shouldn't do that.
Probably not.
I can't imagine eating a koala bear or something like that.
Sounds crazy, say Tom Hubrick, and before that, Heather and Landon Godsey. But it just might work. Conservation scientist Gary Nabhan edited the new book.
Well, for heirloom seeds and heritage livestock breeds, yes. For wild species, it may be a couple generations before we see them on our plates again, but we want to engage people in their recovery and their habitat restoration, and by reminding people that these foods have been an important part of the historic dietary of America, we think we can motivate people besides self-described environmentalists to play a part in this conservation.
It's an idea that makes sense to Eric Rice of Country Pleasures Farm in Middletown, Maryland. He grows a rare species of apple called the black twig.
By eating it, you can actually develop a demand for it. And if you develop a demand for it, then more people will grow it. And so there's something to be said for that.
That's right. A lot of wonderful flavors have fallen off our kitchen table because they've lost market demand, a lot of them because they couldn't be shipped all the way across the country. So if we create local market demand for these, if we take these place-based heritage foods and make them the pride of our festivals and fairs and Thanksgivings and picnics again, they will come back from the brink of extinction and be available not just as part of our biodiversity, but part of our culinary heritage again.
Gary Nabhan's book is loaded with recipes using things you've never heard of. The black sphinx date, the northern giant cabbage, and the Tennessee fainting goat.
The Tennessee fainting goat looks as if it has just seen Elvis and swooned. But in fact, it has wonderful meat characteristics for barbecue. But it was on the brink of extinction, and now people in Tennessee and Texas and surrounding states are bringing it back.
What's it taste like?
Well, it depends how you fix it. You can't fix these heritage breeds, these meats, as if they're a frozen Angus steak. The best chefs in the country are experimenting with them. And, for example, I've had the mule foot hog cooked by Kurt Fries of Iowa City, Iowa. It was the best pork I have ever had, hands down.
Sounds great for dinner on the town, but it's not great news for those of us without celebrity chefs at home. At the local farmers market, we find out something else. There's a reason why producers go with more conventional breeds. Take egg seller Tom Hubrick. He loves his Golden Comet chickens.
They're always on time, they're always cheery, and they don't call in sick. So how much better does it get? You know, so if I do have to negotiate with them, it's very simple. It's either my way or your soup.
But, Hubrick says, a more obscure heritage breed wouldn't do him much good.
They don't lay a large egg. You know, the biggest is a medium egg. So, and most people want large or extra large eggs.
At another stall here, Corey Childs sells mutton and lamb from his farm in Virginia. It is a boutique operation. The sheep are grass-fed and, he says, humanely raised. But they're not a heritage breed. He says those take too long to raise.
The longer it takes you to get an animal from birth to market ready, the longer it takes you to get any return on your investment. So that's usually the downside. The plus side to it is normally they have more flavor in some cases.
Your mouth watering yet? Gary Nabhan says start looking for heritage foods locally.
Many of them can still be found in farmers markets across the country, but just in three or four farmers markets. Some can now be found on the internet through Local Harvest, a website that lists all of the rare foods of exquisite flavor that can be sustainably harvested, and indeed find out how to direct order these foods from the farmers and fishers that offer them still.
So remember that black twig apple? It's dark red, almost like a plum. It's a great storage apple, says Eric Rice.
They are an old southern variety of apple from the mid-1800s, and that a few folks have worked to save the trees, and so they are now available. And we've been using them now to make stewed apples with calvados.
Calvados?
Oh, calvados is the step beyond apple brandy.
Oh, it's
spectacular would be the word. Born for cider. There's no question it's born for cider. It's probably the reason it survived in that part of the world, since the mountains of southern Appalachia is known for a lot of things, not the least of which was being able to make alcohol out of a lot of things.
There are more rare foods and recipes from Gary Nabhan's book, Renewing America's Food Traditions, at our website, npr.org/books. Check out the recipe for crow bison cattail stew and Mission Wine Punch.
Heads up, our next guests appeared on Oprah this past Friday. Weekend Edition food essayist Bonnie Wolf has been to Michigan and back with a story to tell about Zingerman's Deli. In 1982, Paul Saginaw and Ari Weinzweig opened their deli in a red brick building in Ann Arbor, Michigan, so they could get a decent corned beef sandwich. After 26 years, they have built an empire called Zingerman's Community of Businesses that Inc. magazine called the coolest small company in America.
This is not your grandfather's deli. Yes, Zingerman's has corned beef, pastrami, and chopped liver. But they also carry estate-bottled olive oils, farmhouse cheeses, varietal vinegars, grits from South Carolina, and chocolate bars from Madagascar. In Ann Arbor, Zingerman's is to food what the University of Michigan is to education. After a successful first decade, it was time to grow. Another Ann Arbor institution, Borders Books, grew out of Ann Arbor. Zingerman's had a different idea. Co-founder Ari Weinzweig.
There was sort of the challenge that if you don't replicate, how do you grow? So we came up with a vision that outlined this community of businesses where we would have a series of different Zingerman's businesses, but all here in the Ann Arbor area, each with its own unique specialty, operating as one organization, but with these sort of semi-autonomous pieces within it, and each with managing partner or partners in it that had a financial stake invested and had a passion for running it.
The first new Zingerman's was a bakery. It runs 24 hours a day, turning out traditionally made breads. Esquire magazine singled out Zingerman's farm loaf in its best sandwich feature.
Right now I'm actually very high on what we call the Roadhouse bread. It's actually historical roots are, it was the bread of New England in the 18th and 19th century. It was then called Ryan Indian bread. And it's in pretty much every New England cookbook from that era. It's a mix of rye, wheat, and cornmeal. And it's got a little molasses in it, which historically used to come up in abundance from the West Indies with the rum. And it's a fantastic bread, but I also love the farm bread. I love the French mountain bread we do, which is organic, germ-restored. And I like them in the really big loaves. We do it in a 2-kilo traditional loaf, which is great.
That's more than 4 pounds of bread. Now, in addition to the deli and bakery, there's Zingerman's Creamery, where local milk is used to make fresh cheese, old-fashioned cream cheese, and gelato. Try the pistachio. Zingerman's mail order brings in close to 30% of their business. Zingerman's Coffee Company is a wholesale roaster, and Zingerman's Roadhouse is a full-service restaurant serving regional American food. Did I mention Zingerman's Catering? Since by 2007 they'd already accomplished everything in their 2009 vision, they don't do strategic planning, they do visioning. They've begun work on Zingerman's 2020 vision. What's left to do? Ari Weinzweig.
Anything to do with food. You could pick a cuisine, we could have that restaurant.
They encourage employees to come up with good ideas and start a Zingerman's business. And all employees know the bottom line since Zingerman's posts its sales figures on big dry erase boards weekly. This year, they project $34 million in sales. Weinzweig expects there will be 12 to 18 interrelated Zingerman's businesses by 2020. As of today, there is interest in a traditional Mexican restaurant, food publishing, traditional brewing, organic farming, and a spice shop. But the 2020 vision is about more than new businesses, says Weinzweig, who wears black jeans, black T-shirt, and earrings and looks more like an old hippie than a CEO.
The sustainable farmer always leaves the soil in as good or better a condition as when he or she started the work. And so the lead of the 2020 vision is really our commitment to do that, not just for the soil, but for everything and everybody that we interact with, so that when people work here, that they leave employment here, whether it's short or long term, better for the experience, that as a customer you leave better for the experience, that the people that we buy from are better for having sold to us, that the community is better off for us having been here, and then of course all the environmental and food issues as well. And then, you know, it goes through a whole range of things from having fun to continuing to radically improve our food quality and our service quality and to be an educational resource, etc.
Whatever they do, Ari Weinzweig says they won't stop having fun.
Fun is in our guiding principles, and it's in the 2020 vision. Life is short, and even when times are hard, which they have been and I'm sure will be again, you know, it's important to enjoy the people and the food and the customers and everything that we get to be around. I mean, I feel very fortunate to be around such a great group of people and to work with such great products.
For NPR News, this is Bonnie Wolf.
And the best climate for champagne is in Champagne, that region in northeastern France that's the only place that champagne is produced. Everything else is just sparkling wine. So to meet exploding world demand for real bubbly, the French are expanding the area where champagne can be produced. Eleanor Beardsley reports.
Alongside the patchwork vineyards that cover the rolling hillsides of Champagne, stone markers bear the names of the great French champagne houses, Moët & Chandon, Tétanger, Pommerie. The markers lay claim to the Pinot Noir, Pinot Meunier, and Chardonnay grapes that will burst forth this fall from these sunny hillsides with their characteristic chalky soil. A recording of Gregorian monks echoes through the abbey in the hilltop village of Auvillay. Here lies the tomb of Dom Petrus Perignon, the monk who accidentally discovered champagne more than 300 years ago when a batch of wine over-fermented. Despite his faux pas, says abbey caretaker 80-year-old Roger Janvaux, Dom Perignon was a meticulous vintner.
Oh,
he had a whole philosophy about making wine.
For instance, the horses had to be well-fed so they wouldn't shake the grape carts, and the grapes had to be harvested with the early morning dew. Oh, yes, yes.
Oui, oui, voilà.
Santé, bonheur et prospérité.
Merci.
Christophe Mignon opens and shares one of the finest bottles in his cellar. Most champagne comes from small producers like the Mignon family, who have been making it for five generations. On the walls of Mignon's cellar hang photos of his great-grandparents working the vineyards. Later, standing mid-slope amidst rows of vines on a sun-drenched hillside, Mignon describes what makes champagne special.
For me, the real quality of champagne is in the vines. Each vine absorbs the different tastes, odors, and influences from the soil and transmits it to the grapes and wine. And the taste is slightly different depending where on the slopes the vines are planted.
Last year, the region sold 340 million bottles of champagne worldwide. About half that was consumed in France. Britain and the U.S. imported record quantities, and new markets are heating up in China, Japan, and the Middle East. As demand increases, a century-old law that restricts production to 370 villages in the Champagne region is no longer sufficient, says Eric Champion, director of the French Champagne Control Board.
We've named 40 new communities that meet the specific quality criteria, and they will be able to produce champagne. You can't grow champagne grapes like you can grow wheat or beets. Champagne is produced when the know-how passed down through generations interacts with a specific physical environment.
Écoutez, bienvenue. Bienvenue à Loivre.
Michel Guillou is mayor of Loivre, one of the villages on the new Champagne list. Loivre, population 1,100, was completely destroyed during World War I. While its church and houses were rebuilt in the 1920s, the village has never quite recovered. Guillou says being added to the list would be a new beginning for the town.
This could have a big economic impact on the village and would really change our image because we would be producing the best wine in the world. And I permit myself to say this to the American radio.
A committee of experts still has to do a technical assessment of such factors as the soil, bedrock, altitude, and exposure of the land to determine which areas are best suited to produce quality champagne. Loivre farmer Philippe Vacher looks out on his sugar beet and barley fields, which would skyrocket in value if he is authorized to plant champagne grapes here.
Un rêve réaliste, disons. C'est très bien les...
Yes, it would be a dream come true if we could plant vines here. But let's be realistic. It would be a lot of hard work because making champagne means following strict rules. But still, it does change your vision to think that one day there will be vineyards in Loivre.
But Vacher says he isn't getting too excited yet. The experts are not expected to make their recommendations for several more years. For NPR News, I'm Eleanor Beardsley in Champagne, France.